We're reading this afternoon from Genesis chapter 10, which is you can find on page 9 in the Bibles on the tables, if you'd like to read along with me. We're reading Genesis chapter 10, verses 1 to 5, and then skipping on to verse 21. These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphath, Togarmah. The sons of Javan, Elishash, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. From these, the coastland people spread in their lands, each with his own language, by their clans in their nations. We skip on to verse 21 across the page. To Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, children were born. The sons of Shem, Elam, Asher, Arpachshad, Lud, and Aram. The sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arpachshad fathered Shelah, and Shelah fathered Eber. To Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan fathered Almadad, Sheleph, Hazarmaveth, Gerah, Hadoram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abimael, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. All these were the sons of Joktan. The territory in which they lived extended from Mesha in the direction of Sephar to the hill country of the east. These are the sons of Shem, by their clans, their languages, their lands, and their nations. These are the clans of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, in their nations, and from these the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words, and as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth.
Good afternoon and welcome, and thank you for joining us. At the opening of the 2015 Rugby World Cup, as at every World Cup, the theme song was sung. "There's a dream I feel, so rare, so real, all the world in union, the world at one." This week, the England rugby coach, Eddie Jones, said that everyone hates England, and he hopes that his players will harness that hatred against Ireland this weekend. Is the world in union at one, or are we divided by fierce rivalries? This week I was discussing the EU with some friends, and as cabinet ministers began to declare one way or the other, One guy said, "And the war begins." To which another replied, "I thought the EU was supposed to bring peace." And that's right, the EU motto is "United in Diversity." Yet we're having a referendum to decide if we want to leave. Are we really united in diversity? Or did the differences in geography and culture and language and economics actually divide us? And while divisions about sport or politics may not be that serious, there are divisions in our world that are much more damaging. So the UN Charter, signed by every member state, determines to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. Yet in every year since the UN was founded, countless wars have occurred across the world. Is the human race really determined to end the scourge of war? Or will we always find reason to start another? Why is our world so fractured? Why on the one hand do we have this deep desire for unity expressed in sporting anthems and the documents of international organisations? But yet on the other hand, signs of division are everywhere. How come we have this desire to be together, yet we're always pulling ourselves apart? Well, we've seen again and again in Genesis, if you've been here, that these chapters God's put right at the start of the Bible lay foundations that mean that we can really understand the world as it is. And so let's look at these ones together. Let's start with chapter 10, which first point on your sheets, which you were given on the way in, that may help you follow. First point on your sheets. Chapter 10 shows us where we are, profoundly united, but deeply divided. Chapter 10 begins, if you look at verse 1, with the phrase, "These are the generations of," which we've seen a few times now, is a marker to show we're starting a new section. So verse 1, we've moved on to the generations of the sons of Noah. Remember that we finished last week after the floods. All humanity had been destroyed, except Noah and his sons and their wives. And so as we read through Noah's family tree here, the writer is taking us on a tour around the world of his day. And he shows that humanity is characterised by two big things. We're shown both that there's a way in which humanity is profoundly united. There is a common bond that ties us all together, whoever we are. But at the same time, we're reminded that humanity is profoundly divided. Profoundly united, but deeply divided. First, the unity comes from the way this list of nations is still at root a family tree. So look again at verse 1. These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. That's how you might introduce a family photo album, not how you begin an atlas. But that's the point. The atlas is Noah's family tree. And the list ends, if you look at verse 32, with a similar statement showing that all this list, the whole world from start to finish, is Noah's family. And that family history feeling is spelled out by the way each son's list is packaged. So verse 6, if you look down, begins the sons of Ham. And then verse 20, these are the sons of Ham. Or verse 21, Shem's children begin. And then verse 31 at the end concludes, these are the sons of Shem. So there's no one in this list of the whole world who's not related. Each name mentioned comes from one of Noah's sons, and each of them come from Noah. So this passage looks around the world and sees profound unity. The human race is one race, one big family. And the fact that most of these names probably mean nothing to us, these peoples, these nations, we've never heard of them. That's exactly the point in one sense. Even the people we've never heard of, even they're part of our family. Because even they're descended from Noah. But at the same time, the writer shows that humanity is also deeply divided. Even though we're in the same family as these names we've never heard of, at the same time they feel so distant and alien and different. And look again at verse 20. Or at verse 31, which is very similar. At the same time as showing us that all these nations are from one son or the other, we're reminded that they're made up of different clans, different languages, different lands, making different nations. There may be one big human family, But within that family, there are serious boundaries that keep us apart. And this chapter isn't just showing us division in general, but that division is sometimes very personal and very painful. So verses 2 to 5 tick off Japheth's sons very quickly, as they don't play much part in the Bible story from here on. But Ham's descendants, verses 6 to 20, are given much more time. Because to an ancient Israelite reading this, simply hearing some of these names would drive home the deep divisions that mar humanity. So verse 6, the sons of Ham, Cush, Egypt, who, if you know your Bible story, oppressed ancient Israel for centuries and tried to wipe them out in genocide. The unity disappears as soon as you mention Egypt, or when verse 6 mentions Canaan, who, verses 15, 16 and 17, leaves rise to all these nations that surrounded ancient Israel and caused them such misery. Or verse 8, Cush, verse 8, he fathered Nimrod, who, verse 10, founded Babel, which later becomes Babylon. And also verse 11, he founded Assyria. And Babylon and Assyria were two of Israel's mortal enemies. So this world tour may at first remind us of some sense of profound human unity, but it also drives home the deep divisions all around us. It'd be a bit like reading a list of the current cabinet to David Cameron. On the one hand, he'd see that they're all now Tories. They're no longer any of those Liberal Democrats kicking around. There's a sense of real unity. But at the same time, as he read through the names, Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, the deep divisions would be painfully obvious. But however bitter the Tory party may or may not get, the bitter divisions in this list would be much more serious for an ancient Israelite, much worse, much more like the bitterness between the warring factions in Syria, or between Russia and Ukraine, or between North and South Korea. You could sidle up to North Korea's supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, and you could remind him of the common humanity. You could even remind him of the common Korean heritage of North and South. But it would just be rubbing his face in the pain of a people divided. And I wouldn't fancy your chances with him. The world we live in is the world of Genesis chapter 10. Almost every one of these names may be lost to us now. But as humanity, we are in one sense profoundly united and yet also deeply divided. Now, whether it's on the sports fields or the battlefields, we see it wherever we look. But in the Bible, God doesn't just expose us to real clarity about what our world is like, but he shows us why that's how it is. And so point two on your sheets. Let's move on to see what God says about how we got here. And I wondered if you noticed, as Dale read, that chapter 10 and chapter 11 haven't been put in strict chronological order. So look at 11 verse 1. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. But you think, hang on, we've just been hearing in chapter 10 verse 31 of the sons of Shem with their languages. Or back to verse 21, the sons of Ham with their languages. So chapter 10 gives us this snapshot of their world. And although the names are different, it's a snapshot of our world too. Profoundly united, but deeply divided. But then chapter 11 explains how we got to where we are. It shows us why the world is as it is. And it does that by taking us back to a time, still after the flood, but before these deep divisions. And shows us first verses 1 to 4, humanity united by universal ambition. First subpoint there. And let me read from verse 2 again. As people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. So what is this universal ambition? Well, verse 4, it's to stick together and build a tower. But that doesn't sound too bad, does it? Working together, unity, team building. These are some of the buzzwords of our culture, so much so you may be sick of them in your office and the kind of cheesy cliches that they bring. But look more closely at their motivation. It's not the tower that's the problem. God made us creative technological beings. What's wrong is the reason they want it. Verse 4, they want its top in the heavens. But again, surely they're just aiming high. Is there anything wrong with that? Well, the rest of the verse shows that reaching to the heavens is more than just a height target. Verse 4 continues, let us make a name for ourselves. They're doing this out of pride. This new humanity after the flood, they think they're something and they want to show it. And then look again at the end of verse 4. Lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And again, we could think, well, what's the big deal? You know, we all know we're better if we stick together. But what was the first command that God gave to Adam and Eve at creation? What was the first command he repeated to Noah as soon as he was off the ark? Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So sticking together isn't a wise plan, but it's a rejection of God's plan. It's a replacement of God's vision for the earth with their vision. Exactly as Adam and Eve back in Eden rejected God's command and decided they'd call the shots, so too here, this new humanity is trying to take God's place. Reaching to the heavens, if you like, to evict God. Making a name for themselves to replace God. Sticking together to ignore God. This is humanity united by universal ambition to stage a coup and take control. But if humanity was united in rebellion, God's response, verses 5 to 9, is to divide humanity in a universal judgment. So second subpoint, divided by universal judgment. And verse 5 is amusing, isn't it? The Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of man had built. So they think they're making the greatest monument the world will ever see. And they think their project will rival God's. But it's so pathetic God has to stoop down to even see it. And end of verse 5, they're just like children playing their silly games with some blocks. But although it's pathetic, God must act. And verse 6 tells us why. The Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. This isn't God being insecure at a rival. Just a couple of chapters ago, we saw that he wiped out all humanity in the floods. There is no question who's in charge here or how easily God could have ended it all. No, rather God knows he must act to restrain human evil. He sees that this tower would be the start of humanity clubbing together, planning and carrying out rebellious act after rebellious act. So just as in chapter 3, he cast Adam and Eve out of the garden so they could not eat of the tree of life. God puts a check. He acts in judgment to restrain evil. And his judgment is to totally reverse their ambition. And see how cleverly this has been constructed. So verse 7, God says, come, let us go down and confuse their language. Just as in verse 3, they said, come, let us make bricks. And there's a Hebrew wordplay that gets lost in translation, but it's a bit like they said, come, let us mix up bricks. And God says, come, let us mix up their language. With the result, verse 8, that they're dispersed over the face of the earth, which is the very thing in verse 4 they've been trying to avoid. And so verse 9, they really do make a name for themselves. But it's a record of God's judgment on them, rather than their replacement of him. And we finish verse 9. With the Lord confusing the language of all the earth, whereas verse 1, the whole earth had begun with one language. Total reversal. So humanity is united by this universal ambition to replace and remove God. But he will not allow it. And he has acted with one universal act of judgment to divide humanity into clans and languages and peoples and nations. And so chapter 11 leaves us with the world of chapter 10. The world that is all around us. A humanity that is profoundly united, yet at the same time fundamentally divided. And so as we wrap up, point 3, where does this leave us? Well, firstly, this passage means that we can understand division in a way that our world never will. First, I think we need to be clear. God is not against variety or diversity when they're expressed under his good rule. God made human beings with a capacity for the rich wealth of culture that we see around the world. God made us creative, and he made us able to look and sound and act differently to each other while still living under his rule. He didn't make humanity to be monochrome. But if we let what God says here shape how we see our world with its divisions by nation and language, if we're seeing things as God says they are, then we will see this world as a place that bears the marks of God's judgment. And we will see national boundaries and passports and language classes, the need for those things as God's check on human pride. A daily reminder to us almost of the foolishness of humanity trying to go it alone. And we won't think of division as just a sort of random product of human activity, but as the deliberate action of God to restrain rebellious humanity. My wife, Bethan, was once in Spain, and a Spanish lady asked her a question. And my wife has some Spanish, and she meant to say, sorry, I don't understand, because I don't speak Spanish. The lady laughed in her face and walked off, and she then realised she'd actually said, sorry, I don't understand, because you don't speak Spanish. But that's because of Genesis 11. The fact that I can meet a fellow human being, a fellow member of my global family, and yet not even understand a word they say, reminds me of God's judgment on human pride. But as we well know, this leads to more than just misunderstandings. The splits between nations, the barriers of language, these fundamental divisions lead to violence and mistrust. They lead to racism, they lead to war. And so second, this passage helps us think about undoing division. And of course, we've made huge progress in communication and cooperation between nations in lots of ways. And obviously, lots of you will be crossing language barriers on a daily basis in your work. But this fundamental lesson from the beginning of Genesis must keep our naive optimism in check. We mustn't kid ourselves that by ourselves, we will reach some sort of utopia through international cooperation. God has acted fundamentally to stop that happening. And so whether it's the UN or the EU or the Six Nations or the Olympics this summer, there's lots of good we can be thankful for, of course. There's a diversity we can celebrate. And the UN has done some good in restraining violence. But it will never rid the world of war. It will never gather the nation into perfect unity. God has made it impossible. David Cameron was responding to the Leave campaign this week by saying, "You say Britain outside Europe will be a utopia, yet have no idea what it would look like." And, you know, in the EU, out the EU, they may each have potential benefits. But whichever way we go, if we've grasped this passage, we do know one thing, that neither inside or outside will ever be a utopia, a perfect world. So don't be seduced by these naive claims of a world in union, a world at one. It's not rare, it's not real, it is impossible. And we will never realise total unity despite this diversity. We'll never reach a world of free of the scourge of war. God has frustrated our plans to unite without him. This is a wake-up call, I think, when it comes to undoing division. But does that leave us totally hopeless? Well, Genesis so far has been full of ups and downs, hasn't it? So we've seen judgment before, but there's always been a little bit of hope. Adam and Eve were sent out of the garden, but God promised an offspring to defeat Satan. Cain was cursed, but he was protected by God. The flood came, but Noah was preserved. Each time we've been left with a little bit of hope. But the end of this installment is just bleak. The problems we saw last week in One Family are now global problems. The ongoing experience of life in this world has just been frustrated even more. Which leaves us crying out, what next? Where do we go from here? Well, if that's how we're feeling, we're exactly where we need to be to hear chapter 12, which William will look at next week. But just in case you're not here next week, or you can't take a whole week of bleakness, in chapter 12, God steps in and makes some incredible promises to a guy called Abraham. Just look at the end of chapter 12, verse 3. He says, "In you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." God is about to do something in Genesis. And to answer the frustration of this world, he's going to do something good. And to match the global judgment we've just seen, this good thing is going to impact every nation. And when we reach the New Testament, we discover that this promise to Abraham of global blessing is right at the heart of the good news which Jesus came to bring to all nations. God here scatters and divides, but in Jesus he is gathering and uniting. And so if you share this longing for a world united, but you can see, being honest, that it is just beyond us, then join Jesus' people and throw yourself behind what Jesus is doing in this world. Because only through Jesus will there one day be a world that really is at one. A world that is rich in diversity, but still knows perfect unity under his good rule. Well, over to you now. There's a short break for coffee. If there are things you disagreed on or things you wanted to ask questions about or weren't clear, please write down questions. As Wes said, someone will come around and collect them up. And also on your sheets, you'll see a couple of questions I've put there, which you may want to discuss around your tables to think about what we've been hearing a bit more. I'll be up in a few moments' time.
Okay, let's draw back together there. Thanks for some really good questions. It's really useful to have the questions, so thanks for putting them in. Thanks, Ollie, for the talk. Someone has asked, is there any historical evidence to support chapter 10 and the existence of all the different descendants of Noah?
So it depends what you mean by historical evidence. So lots of these can potentially be traced. Some of them we'd still know, you know, Egypt, some of the others that we still know. Lots of them, there is evidence they appear later on in the Bible, and in kind of archaeology, you can go and trace some of that if you want to. I can point you to it. It's not, I don't think it's particularly important to see. And there certainly are, there certainly seems to be parallels between here and what you see in what was Mesopotamia, so ancient the Middle East, what's now Iraq, Iran, in terms of the kind of building, so the ziggurats they have there look very similar, the kind of building techniques, they match up between their bricks and stone, those sorts of differences. And I think it's important also not to take this on its own, so to look at the whole the book of Genesis together and think, do we see the evidence for that? And that kind of question I would always go and say, look at the way Jesus treats Genesis. He reads it as historical, he reads it as real history. And I'd go with what he says on it.
Brilliant. Thanks, Ollie. If anyone's got any questions about Bible reliability, please do come and ask. There's loads of good books we could point you to. Really good question. Why does the Bible here focus on Noah's sons, not on his daughters?
Don't know. I guess it's the way their culture works, is that you would trace descent through the male line. That isn't to say the Bible is kind of sexist. That is just the way it was done in those days. And so that's the way it's recorded for us. But that's not to say that God doesn't care about daughters. I've got three of them, so I hope he does.
Great. Thanks, Ollie. Now, is the problem here man's differences or man's sin, somebody has said? Could you clarify that? Is it man's differences or man's sin?
So the problem is both. But it's man's sin that leads to differences. So I think we see the same pattern here as we saw in, if you're here in Genesis chapter 3. So Adam and Eve rebel against God and sin, they reject him. And therefore God brings his curse on this world and leads to frustration and pain and death ultimately. Similar pattern here. So man's sin, their rebellion, their ambition to try and displace God and take over the world leads to him imposing languages and differences on us, and that is what causes some of the friction.
Thanks, Ollie. Just a good question here, just pushing that a little bit further. Is it your view, therefore, that any efforts of global peace, etc., that are wholly secular and not God-driven are destined to fail, i.e. is the UN pointless?
Good question. No, the UN is not pointless. The UN has done a lot of good in God's kindness, even though it is a secular organisation, in restraining evil. And but equally, you can very clearly see its limits. I think it depends what you mean. So if you mean in terms of making any temporary benefit at all, obviously there is a lot of good in secular solutions. If you're talking about an actual end to world conflict and human violence, then yes, anything that hasn't got Jesus and his work at the centre is ultimately going to fail. And I think that means that there is a bit of a tension there, so you don't want to write these things off completely and say it's all pointless. But you also don't want to put all your hopes into it and put hopes that are too big onto it. So I think it's right that we pray for people in government, people at the UN, politicians, whoever, in the kind of reconciliation, mediation that's going on around the world. That's a good thing. But if we think that is the solution, then we'll be wrong. And actually, the gospel, the good news of Jesus, is the only solution that will really make a difference.
Thanks, Ollie. Can I just push you a bit on that? You said at the end of your talk, if we want a solution to this problem that we see in Genesis, then you said we should throw ourselves behind Jesus, and you just said that is the solution. How would we actually do that? What does that actually involve, to throw ourselves behind Jesus' work?
Yeah, it'll mean lots of different things. The first thing is if it is to join Jesus' people yourself. So if you're not a Christian or you're not sure where you stand, the reason that is a solution that is going to work is that it's not just trying to fix things horizontally between people, but it starts by fixing the root cause here, which is human sin against God. So that's the thing that really needs fixed. And that's why secular solutions aren't ever going to succeed to put us all back together. But once we're right with God, which Jesus' death means that our sin can be taken away, means we can be forgiven. Once we're put right with God, then we can be reconciled, we can be genuinely joined to each other. And so that's the key thing, is to be part of that yourself. But then also, that's the thing that will bring division. So to get behind that looks like trying to point people to that as the solution, not to other things. Again, for other people, primarily for them to be brought back into relationship with God, but also that is then the thing. You see, then reconciles people's families and the world. So you see it on a global level. You see parts of the world where there has been great bitterness and conflicts, where because people become Christians, you get churches full of people that otherwise would hate each other. But you also see that, say, people's families level. So there's one guy who became a Christian a couple of years ago who had barely spoken to his parents in decades, I think, and became a Christian, and therefore there was able to be forgiveness and reconciliation. So, but yeah, getting behind that will look like lots of different things for each of us.
That's really helpful. That's brilliant, Ollie. Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone, for being here today. As Ollie said, next week, William will be speaking on chapter 12, fleshing out what Ollie said there, what is the good news. Please do stick around if you'd like to. Please come and chat with Ollie if you'd like to find out more. Sorry for those questions we didn't tackle. Come and ask, and hopefully see you either next Tuesday or next Thursday. Thank you very much.